10 years later, how have 9/11 and its repercussions changed our language? Not as much as people expected, says our linguist Jeff Nunberg.
They were instant cliches, but they needed saying anyway. September 11th was our Pearl Harbor. It would change the way we think and create a new normal. It defined a generation. And from the beginning, people looked to the language to bear witness to how utterly differently we were seeing the world. 10 years later, it's not so clear. I've been making a list of all the words I've been tracking since 2001 that were connected to 9/11 and its repercussions. It's a jumble, axis of evil and the army you have, cakewalk, coalition of the willing and connect the dots, dead or alive and don't touch my junk, evildoers and enhanced interrogation. But the one thing that jumps out at me is how ephemeral they are. Most have already disappeared. And apart from 9/11 itself, few of the rest will be around a decade from now. Of course, buzzwords come and go, but it's striking that 9/11 and its after effects have left almost no traces in the language of everyday life. Shortly after the attacks, the Washington Post reported that teenagers were calling a punishment a jihad and describing hot salsa as weapons grade. I'm dubious, to put it mildly, but if anybody ever did use those words, they didn't catch on. Nor did we pick up on any of the pungent slang of the soldiers serving in war zones, like embrace the suck for deal with it, or Casper for a gold bricker who disappears when there's work to be done. That's the big linguistic difference between 9/11 and World War II. That war left a vast legacy in the American vocabulary. Beachhead, blitz, blockbuster, and bloodbath, boondocks, blackout, and brown nose, just to name some of the B's. I know, it's not a fair comparison. In World War II, just about every family had someone in the service, and the war affected the lives of everybody on the home front, the rationing and scrap metal drives, the women pouring into the workforce, the families pulling out their world atlases to listen to the news on the radio. Yet even Vietnam contributed more items to the language than 9/11 has, including some that were recycled over the last decade, like hawks and doves, stay the course, and light at the end of the tunnel. But wars could only have that kind of broad effect on the language when they reached so deeply into the life of a people that they created a common point of reference. At that point, it felt natural to use military words like blockbuster, beachhead, and flak as metaphors for everyday experience. That didn't happen here. In those first days, Americans were desperate to do something to help. People drove across the country to lend a hand at Ground Zero, lined up to give blood, collected food and clothing. It was heartwarming, but as it turned out, it wasn't really necessary. This war wasn't going to have much of a home front. In fact, if you were lucky enough not to be one of the few people whose lives were devastated, then by the weird logic of terrorism, you could be most helpful by not doing anything different at all. The patriotic thing to do, the president told us, was just to go to Disney World as planned. I think of that absurd but telling phrase that appeared just after the attacks: if we cancel the party or don't send the marching band to the Rose Bowl, then the terrorists win. Everybody knew it was a rationalization. Al-Qaeda weren't gnashing their teeth at the thought that Ellen DeGeneres would be hosting the Emmys as scheduled. And by November, the phrase was a joke. The New Yorker ran a cartoon by J.C. Duffy that showed a man in a bar saying, "I figure if I don't have that third martini, then the terrorists win." Yet people kept using the phrase anyway. It helped them or their customers square their consciences, as it became clear that in the period that followed this new Pearl Harbor, only a few people would be called on to do the serious sacrificing. For the rest of us, the actual hardship would chiefly extend to having to leave for the airport an hour earlier. Even after the dissipation of that sense of common purpose, people didn't tune everything out. We were still anxious and concerned, both about terrorism and about the war on it, even if now they were a focus of contention more often than unity. And we were all grateful to the 5 or 10% of Americans, civilian and military, who had chosen to put 9/11 and its consequences at the center of their lives. Though now, of course, supporting the troops was less arduous than it was in World War II, when it involved giving up some Saturdays. But when the dust cleared, 9/11 was no longer uppermost in our thoughts. When the American Dialect Society voted on the word of the decade in 2010, 9/11 came in a distant third behind Google and blog. It's hard to argue with that ranking. The internet has gotten a lot more of our attention than 9/11 over the last 10 years, and it's given us a lot more new words. If there's any difference between the new normal and the old, you couldn't tell it from the way we talk.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.
Mail service in the United States goes back to colonial times. In fact, any list of famous postmasters would surely be topped by Benjamin Franklin, who was also involved in newspapers, sort of a new media guy for the 1700s. So it is with some pain that Americans consider the financial trouble of the U.S. Postal Service now. The Postmaster General appeared before a Senate committee that's considering what to do, and NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
Next summer, that's when the U.S. Postal Service says it will run out of money to pay its employees and contractors. If Congress doesn't act fast, it will start missing bills sooner, like a $5.5 billion payment to a retiree health benefit fund due at the end of this month. Patrick Donahue is the Postmaster General.
Our situation is urgent. The congressional action is needed immediately to avoid this default.
He told the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs the Postal Service needs radical changes to its business model. For years, it was all about first-class mail, letters, bills, invitations. And because of the internet, Donahue says that type of mail is on a steep decline.
I think that we could cut the price in half and not be able to slow it down all that much. 60% of Americans pay bills online today. That's not going to change. That will continue to move in that direction.
He says the Postal Service needs to adjust. And if it were a normal business, it could slash costs, raise prices, do whatever it needed. But Senator Tom Carper, a Democrat from Delaware, said it can't, not without the help of Congress.
No business facing the kinds of difficulty the Postal Service faces today would survive very long if it were told how many retail outlets they should have and where they should be located. Yet that's what Congress does to the Postal Service.
So, as it has done many times before, the Postal Service is coming to Congress, asking for permission to change. But getting everything it wants could be mighty difficult. The Postal Service wants to get its hands on some $60 billion it says it overpaid into employee pension funds. It wants to adjust employee health and retirement benefits. And it wants permission to lay off as many as 120,000 postal employees.
These proposals are outrageous, illegal, and despicable.
Cliff Guffey is president of the American Postal Workers Union. He says the union just agreed to a new contract with the Postal Service that included worker concessions but maintained a no-layoff protection.
Now they want to come to the Congress and say, oh, we got this part of the deal. Give us this part back. We think that's totally improper.
The union is also against a proposal to eliminate Saturday delivery, and it has support from Republican Senator Susan Collins from Maine. She says the savings would be minimal and told the postmaster mail order pharmacies and weekly newspapers might take their business elsewhere if they can't get Saturday delivery.
And once these private firms leave the Postal Service behind, they won't be coming back. And the Postal Service will suffer yet another blow to its finances.
The Postal Service seems to be suffering one blow after another. Postmaster Patrick Donahue told the committee he expects a net loss of $10 billion this fiscal year. His goal is to get the Postal Service profitable again by 2013.
Every quarter I have to report losses, and every quarter I go through the same discussion. You know, they can't get their head above water, they're antiquated, they're bad management, the employees don't do a good job. None of that helps. None of that helps because it potentially scares business away.
Senators from both sides of the aisle repeated throughout the hearing they think there should be a fix, and it can be bipartisan. They said the Postal Service is too big a part of the U.S. economy to let it go out of business. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The Capitol.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Until recently, opposition to publicly funded birth control was usually linked to abortion, either because the birth control in question allegedly caused abortion or because the organization providing the birth control also performed abortions. This is changing, though. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, there's a growing chorus of voices who simply don't think the government should be funding contraception.
When the Obama administration last month added contraceptives to the list of services insurance plans must offer without deductibles or copayments, the reaction from the right was swift. Here's Iowa Republican Congressman Steve King on the House floor.
They called it preventative medicine. Preventative medicine. Well, if you apply that preventative medicine universally, what you end up with is you've prevented a generation. Preventing babies from being born is not medicine.
Some opponents, like conservative commentator Sandy Rios, say subsidizing birth control is simply too expensive in an era of tight budgets.
We have $14 trillion in debt, and now we're going to cover birth control, breast pumps, counseling for abuse. Are we going to do pedicures and manicures as well? I think that would be a good idea.
Fox News announcer Sean Hannity suggested women should take more personal responsibility in this exchange on his show with contributor Jemu Green.
Stop expecting other people to be responsible for every minute aspect of your life in this nanny state that you want to create.
But why should we pay for a man's Viagra?
Because that actually is a medical...
Plans, before the Affordable Care Act, some insurance plans wouldn't cover birth control.
That is a medical problem versus a choice to have sex.
Still others, like Marjorie Dannenfelser of the anti-abortion Susan B. Anthony list, insist that providing birth control actually doesn't prevent abortions.
As the money goes up, so do the number of abortions. We have not seen a reduction in abortions since the full funding of family planning. We have seen an escalation.
But that's simply not the case, says Emily Stewart of Planned Parenthood.
Without a doubt, when women have access to birth control, it reduces unintended pregnancies. The truth is, we need to do more to improve access to birth control.
Abortion opponents are correct that widespread access to birth control hasn't eliminated abortions in this country, although the number has declined considerably over the past two decades. But supporters of birth control like Stewart say the reason is that there hasn't been enough access to contraception. Funding for the federal government's main family planning program has largely remained flat over the years, mostly due to abortion-related fights, so it hasn't kept up with inflation or population growth. As a result, Stewart says,
millions and millions of Americans who are in need of publicly funded family planning services today are not getting access to family planning services.
But Helen Alvarez, a law professor at George Mason University, says she thinks there may be yet another reason why widespread use of birth control hasn't brought down the rate of unintended pregnancy more dramatically.
If you lower the cost of things, people will buy more of it. And you lower the cost of uncommitted sexual encounters, you completely dissociate sex from pregnancy and birth and a lifetime of childcare, people will engage in more uncommitted sexual encounters.
But the question remains, why is it only now that objections to birth control are being raised in public? John Green, who studies religion and politics at the University of Akron, says he thinks it has a lot to do with the recent battles over federal spending in general and the new health law in particular.
It's almost as if a threshold has been crossed in the debate. I think a lot of conservative activists believe that, at least in this area, the public sector has become a little larger than it should be and is threatening some of the basic values that they hold.
But while calls to end federal funding for contraception may be on the rise, the public remains firmly on the other side, at least for now. A survey released last week by the Kaiser Family Foundation found two-thirds of respondents in favor of the new requirement for insurance plans to offer prescription birth control without a copay or deductible. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Adam Mansbach is the author of a popular children's book for adults. It's about the struggle many parents have getting their kid to sleep. We can't say the whole title of this book on the radio, but it's essentially Go to Sleep, plus a bit of vulgarity to get the point across. Mansbach recently revisited some of his childhood favorites and found to his surprise that they are still just as good as he remembers. Here he is for our series, Three Books.
If there's anything the writers I know share besides an unhealthy relationship to caffeine, it's a childhood spent immersed in books. All my young adult favorites look more like accordions than novels because they've been dropped into the bathtub so many times. They're also seared into my consciousness like few novels I've read since. I used to chalk that up to the impressionability of youth until I started revisiting those stories and realizing how well they stand up as literature. The ones I continue to love now tend to confront complex social issues bravely, convey emotions with tremendous empathetic clarity, and rest on compelling narrative voices. In other words, the very elements that draw me into novels today. In Bruce Brooks' The Moves Make the Man, it's 1961, and Wilmington, North Carolina's white junior high school has just been integrated by exactly one student, our narrator Jerome Foxworthy, the J. Fox. Deeply observant, wise beyond his years, and a basketball prodigy, the J. Fox befriends a troubled classmate. Bix is a baseball star who needs to master basketball in order to confront his stepfather and gain access to his institutionalized mother. But the concept of faking, though central to the game, is anathema to Bix's radical notion of honesty. Not only does this book deserve a place in the pantheon of great American race novels, it also features some of the most astute sports writing I've ever read. For the Carnegie-esque Pittsburgh Clan in Father's Arcane Daughter by E.L. Konigsberg, time stopped years ago when the family's eldest daughter was kidnapped. Now a grown woman claiming to be the long-gone Caroline has returned. She's embraced by the family, even as doubts linger in the mind of her young half-brother Winston. Soon it becomes clear that Caroline is there to unlock the cage of fear in which Winston and his younger sister have been forced to live. Atmospheric but never stuffy, this is a finely wrought mystery, as well as a meditation on the truths we choose to live with and the truths we choose to live without. The narrator of John LeVert's The Flight of the Cassowary is a teenage boy with a keen interest in biology and a pet theory about evolution, that all the instincts and abilities we possessed as more primitive creatures are still inside us somewhere, waiting to be called to action. His friends and family don't take it very seriously until he starts accessing those talents, catching and re-catching a fly with froggish reflexes, summoning gazelle-like speed during a football game, and then channeling more aggressive powers when his skills gain him unwanted attention. LeVert juggles belief and disbelief, science and humor, pathos and romance, with the dexterity of a... what kind of animal can juggle? Returning to these three books reminds me of why I fell in love with reading. Pick one up and lose yourself in it. Why should kids have all the fun?
Adam Mansbach is author of the book Go the Blank to Sleep. For more on his reading recommendations, you can go to our website, npr.org. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leighton. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we get to sample some Latin and African rhythms. We'll speak to Putumayo World Music's founder and CEO about delivering some of the best beats in the business. But first, getting the answers to some difficult questions like, do I let my daughter and her lesbian lover sleep in the same bedroom when visiting? How do I address a salutation to a gay couple? Or must I buy a present for a civil union? Stephen Petro has the answers, and he's the go-to authority on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues. He writes the nationally syndicated advice column, Queries, and his latest book is called Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners. He helps people navigate that community. Welcome to the program, Stephen Petro.
Thank you for having me, Jackie.
You know, this book is really useful for everyone. But first of all, Stephen, you know, it is 2011. Why is there a need for a manners book specifically for the gay and lesbian population?
Part of the answer is that I've been doing an advice column for many years now, and 2 or 3 years ago I started getting just a ton of questions, both from gay people and from straight people, about all these dilemmas in sort of our social interactions. And, you know, there are also all of the same-sex wedding questions. You know, what's your role? If you're a parent, are you supposed to pay? If you're the dad, are you going to be dancing with one of the grooms? And, you know, there are just a ton of questions for people who are coming out. What's a respectful way to do that? And if someone does come out to you, how do you respond? So this book is it's a big book of manners for everyone about all of these interactions that we have. And it really seemed like the time had come.
So a lot of it is about basically common decency. And then you're saying there are these other things but that do specifically apply to the gay community.
Yes. I mean, a lot of it is common sense. But then some of the specific questions, you know, take a little bit of noodling. And that's, you know, that's what I've been doing over the past several years. You know, for instance, how do you introduce the significant other of your best gay friend? You know, if you're opposite sex married, you'd be, well, that's his wife or that's her husband. But we don't have a standard in our community, so you need to listen to how people introduce themselves. And if they don't, it's actually really just fine to ask, how would you like me to introduce the two of you?
Stephen, you wrote a similar book called The Essential Book of Gay Manners and Etiquette in 1995. I'd like to ask, what's different about this book? How have things changed?
You know, it actually shocked me when I started to think back that really 16 years here is like 1600 in gay years or something like that. Because think back 1995, 1996, that was before online dating. That was before Ellen DeGeneres even came out of the closet, much less, you know, became sort of this lesbian icon. It was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So it's a world of difference.
Your book contains a lot of questions from your nationally syndicated queries column. And let's take a few of these questions, Stephen. A fifth grade teacher wants to know how to help a student who has two moms, and that student wants to create a family tree. Is it all right for the teacher to inquire about the parent's sexuality?
You know, the best thing is for parents and it's to approach the teacher or the schools at the beginning of the school year and talk to them about how their family is constructed, that there are two moms or two dads, and so that the teacher and the school, they're kind of plugged in to that fact when you get to assignments like that, but also to pay attention for, you know, some anti-gay slurs and language that happens. You know, that phrase, "that's so gay," is used, you know, so often in the schools, and it's a very negative, hurtful phrase. And
parents, you mean kids to other kids, you mean that's
yes, okay. And teachers and administrators just need to have an ear for that so that they can stop that, you know, early on.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden, and I'm talking with Stephen Petro. He writes the nationally syndicated advice column Queries, and he's the author of the recently released book, Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners. And here's a timely query from one of your recent columns, and I'm going to start to read. We're going out of our minds. Ever since New York passed the law allowing same-sex couples to get married there, every straight person wants to know when we're getting hitched. A lot of our gay friends are asking us as well. It's become oppressive. Is there a new gay wedding etiquette about this? Well, I don't know, Stephen. What's your rejoinder?
Oh, my God. You know, after that law was passed at the end of June, in the month of July and early August, I was just inundated with that same question in so many different forms. And, you know, I think one of the important things to note is that winning the right to marry doesn't necessarily mean that it's always the right thing for every couple, and it's a choice. And that kind of highlights, you know, a theme in the book, which is there are a lot of well-intentioned questions that come from straight folks to their gay friends and family members. And we in the gay community shouldn't take offense. We should try to have a sense of humor. And, you know, we should also feel free to say, you know, that's private, you know, and to push back a little bit.
Stephen, do you have any one piece of advice that you wish everyone would practice?
Well, I think one of the beautiful things about manners is that it doesn't tell everyone how they should think. It's a tool to help us interact with each other, and especially on issues around gay and lesbian stuff and people. Those who are listening who are not so open-minded in a way about gays, it's not as though you need to make a donation. It's not as though you need to raise a pride flag, but you do need to do your best to be respectful of your gay friends and to be civil at all times.
Well, thanks for writing such a complete primer.
Thank you so much for having me, Jackie.
Stephen Petro writes the nationally syndicated advice column Queries. He's also the author of numerous books for the LGBT community, and his most recent book is called Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners. He joined us from member station WNCU in Durham, North Carolina. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much again.
In London, four former executives of Rupert Murdoch's newspaper empire were summoned by a parliamentary committee yesterday. They faced questions about the tabloid phone hacking scandal that's been making headlines in Britain for weeks now. The version of events these executives offered contradicted previous testimony from their old boss, James Murdoch. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports.
It was a day of testy and colorful exchanges. From just about the outset, British lawmakers challenged the often forgetful former executives and lawyers for their collective veracity, memory, and integrity.
Do you accept that you lied to us when you told us you investigated this and were satisfied with the explanations you received?
Eventually, but you probably realise that people will find that incredible that this was going on.
Would you not admit, Mr. Crane, that your credibility has been somewhat damaged by the...
Those voices belong to MPs Tom Watson, Jim Sheridan, and Louise Mensch, who were grilling the senior executives and lawyers yesterday. The witnesses, by their own description, displayed an astonishing lack of curiosity in the face of explicit allegations of terrible wrongdoing by employees of their own paper, the now-shuttered tabloid News of the World. But the bigger conflict came into focus as the paper's former top lawyer, Tom Crone, and its final editor, Colin Myler, repeatedly clashed with testimony given by their old boss, the younger Murdoch. Both said they told James Murdoch of the implications of a newly discovered and damning memo at a brief but fraught meeting in 2008. The memo proved phone hacking wasn't just limited to a lone rogue editor and a private investigator reporting on the royals. That meeting was swiftly followed by a major payoff to a target of phone hacking who is a figure in professional soccer, indicating another front in the scandal. For example, here's Colin Myler, the paper's final editor before it was shut down this summer, who is being questioned by MP Damian Collins about the meeting with Murdoch and that memo.
He is very clear on his recollection of that meeting. You are not. And that is my,
question. I am clear. I'm sorry, but I am clear. There was no ambiguity about the significance of that document and what options were there for the company to take.
Crone and Myler were vague about what they precisely said to James Murdoch, but their testimony contradicted what he had said earlier this summer. Here, he was being questioned by MP Tom Watson, one of his most outspoken critics.
When you signed off the Taylor payment, did you see or were you made aware of the full Neville email, the transcript of the hacked voicemail message?
No, I was not aware of that at the time.
But you paid an astronomical sum, and there was no reason to.
There was every reason to settle the case, given the likelihood of losing the case and given the damages that we had received counsel would be levied.
Witnesses said yesterday that confidential settlement, costing more than $1 million, was a sound business investment to head off bad publicity and additional lawsuits. Then again, the former executives at times seemingly contradicted some of their own assurances 2 years ago that there was no evidence of widespread voicemail hacking at the paper. The testimony involved episodes that now appear minor, but in other circumstances would themselves be explosive. For example, Crone acknowledged yesterday he had reviewed files compiled by a private investigator working on behalf of the company that were filled with details of the private lives of two lawyers representing phone hacking victims against the Murdoch family's British firm. In a statement yesterday, James Murdoch said he stands behind his earlier testimony. The committee has not yet decided whether to recall him. As one MP said, the whole thing was clear as mud. David Folkenflik, NPR News.